This is The Guardian.
I'm Jane Lee, coming to you from Wurundjeri land. And this is The Full Story. Even though more than half the population will experience menopause at some point in their lives, there's still no definitive list of symptoms for perimenopause, the stage which comes before it. And there remain big questions on the effectiveness of treatments. So what do we know? And why are there still so many unknowns? Today, the science of treating perimenopause. It's Tuesday, the 9th of April.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
So, Bianca, you've been reporting on science for 20 years as a journalist. How has the conversation around menopause changed in that time, do you think?
Well, I guess also I've become more aware of it recently as a perimenopausal woman.
Bianca Nogrady is a science writer for Guardian Australia.
But the fact that we're having so many more conversations around menopause in the public and private domain now is a reflection of that growing awareness and recognition of the long-running neglect of women's health and especially women's pain, both by the medical profession and by medical research.
We know that menopause marks the end of your period or your cycle, and for some, the ability to have children. But what is actually happening to your body when you go through this stage?
So menopause actually refers to that specific point, which is 12 months after somebody has their last period ever. So that's the menopause. Really, when we talk about menopause, really what we're mostly talking about is perimenopause. And that refers to the time frame that leads up to that point and then to 1 year after the final period. So what's happening is essentially this transition occurs because the ovaries run out of eggs. So perimenopause is that process starting to happen. So it's defined by you have fluctuating hormone levels, particularly estrogen. People have irregular and sometimes extremely heavy periods, which is, you know, dreadfully awkward, you know, especially when you, if you've had a regular monthly cycle over most of your life, it's just the biggest of curveballs for so many people. And this can generally start in the 40s or 50s. It can happen early. Some people have early onset menopause. And the other thing that's also important to mention is that perimenopause and menopause are experienced by anybody who has functioning ovaries. And so that includes intersex people, some intersex people. It includes trans men. Trans women take estrogen as part of their transition and they stay on that for life. So they don't generally experience, as far as I understand, something like menopause. Mm. And menopause can happen naturally, quote unquote, but it can also happen surgically if somebody has their ovaries removed for some reason, or it can also be triggered by treatments such as chemotherapy or radiation. So, and then once you kind of, once you've had your final period, after that point, you are postmenopausal.
Right. So lots of different ways you can experience menopause. It sounds like the symptoms must vary quite dramatically between people depending on what you're going through.
It's difficult to really pin down what are the key symptoms. And obviously, you know, this is an incredibly individual experience. And so from one person to the next, those symptoms can vary enormously. What we do know, there are some classic symptoms that are essentially universally recognized as symptoms of perimenopause. So the main one is what's called vasomotor symptoms. So these are the hot flushes and the night sweats. And about 3/4 of people going through perimenopause will have these, and about 1/4 of those will have these quite severely. You feel like you're burning up, you know, your skin gets really hot and flushed. You get sort of, yeah, very flushed skin, really sweaty. You know, you often see women kind of fanning themselves. You know, my friends all have various degrees of fans that they carry around with them. The funny thing is your core temperature doesn't actually change that much. So it's not like you're having a fever or something. But what it is that your subjective experience of temperature is much more, I guess, intense. So even a slight increase in body temperature, you experience as this raging heat. And so it's, you know, the big issue with it, apart from it being people being quite self-conscious, and it can be quite embarrassing if you're, you know, suddenly incredibly sweaty and red-faced. But a big issue as well is that it can disrupt sleep. You know, I have friends who would wake up every 45 minutes to an hour at night, just drenched in sweat. That disruption to sleep, which in some women can last for years, I mean, that's a dreadful, dreadful effect. So that's really the key one. But we know that menopause is associated with changes in your skin. So women experience dry skin, itchy skin. There's also vaginal changes. So people report dryness, burning, irritation, reduced libido, so reduced interest in enjoyment of sex. Some people report increased joint aches and pains. And then I think the big one that is often underappreciated as well is mood changes. And it's a range of things. It's low mood. It's just being a bit shitty with the world. Mm. It's irritation, irritability, rages, you know, just getting irrationally angry. Although, I mean, to be fair, there's a lot to be angry about in the world right now. You know, loss of motivation, exhaustion, being forgetful. A lot of women talk about brain fog, but it's just not really being able to think straight, not being able to motivate yourself. Mm. So it's a challenging period of life, as well as being at, for most of us, approaching the peak of our career. And all of that is a bit of a perfect storm. So that's part of the challenge, is teasing out what is menopausal symptoms or perimenopausal symptoms and what is just life.
Mm. And I mean, to that point, how do these symptoms affect women and gender diverse people at this point in their lives? I mean, what's your personal experience with this, having recently discovered your perimenopausal?
I think for me, I've noticed a sort of irritability and fairly intolerant of challenges in the family environment. It's certainly loss of motivation, loss of confidence, anxiety, low mood a little bit as well. And I guess there are things that I have done less of because of that. It certainly made it challenging for me to really push myself and to do things that are, you know, scary, because I kind of think, oh, you know, really? Am I ready? Am I good enough for that? And again, that can just be where I'm at in life. I don't know. But I have friends who have left jobs because they just felt they could not continue to do the job that they were doing while they were trying to deal with these symptoms. I think it's, and look, it's really also really important to say that a lot of women do not get adversely affected by perimenopause. A lot of people don't get adversely affected. So this isn't something that's going to hit everybody. Some people have terrible symptoms. Some people have no symptoms. So it's really important to emphasize that there is a huge range of experience.
It seems particularly unfair or challenging that just as women are at the peak of their careers that they've built up over a long period of time, they can be struck down by their own body sort of turning against them, if you like. And I don't know, what do you make of that? How have people you've spoken to coped with that?
Yeah, it is unfair, but I think a lot about women's biology in some ways is unfair. I think we do need to be careful of feeding into a narrative that suggests that perimenopausal women are defunct in some Sure. ways, because I think throughout the course of our lives, you know, people who menstruate, we're used to dealing with the ups and downs, the ebb and flow, shall we say, of hormones. And I think in some ways that's what makes women extraordinary, is that this is part of who we are and how we are. And I'd say we thrive with it and despite it. And so, you know, I think what's so important about the fact that we're having these conversations now is to acknowledge that whilst this is supposed to be a peak of a career for women, in some ways the peak for women is probably a little bit later. It's after this. And certainly anecdotally, even just amongst my friends, it's like once you come out the other side of this, it's great. You have this stability. You have this, you know, you don't have to deal with periods anymore. I mean, imagine how much money you save on not being on the pill, on not having to buy tampons or pads or whatever. There's an amazing freedom that does come after this period in life. Mm. And I know, I think we also need to celebrate that and recognize that.
And how long roughly does it take usually to get to the other side?
Well, it can vary a lot. I mean, some women it can be a couple of years, some women it can be 15 years. It's a huge, I know. I mean, some people report they still have hot flushes after 10, 15 years.
Next, the controversial history of perimenopause treatment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
So you've written extensively on menopausal hormone treatment, or MHT. What is that and how does it work today?
So essentially what we have today is two different types of MHT, or what used to be known as HRT, or hormone replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. So there's either estrogen alone, and or there's estrogen plus progesterone. So progesterone is another sex hormone that's really important in menstruation. And that also is something that drops with perimenopause. And the purpose is basically just to stabilize and boost those declining levels of estrogen. The reason that we have two different types is that if you have estrogen alone, it can increase the risk of uterine cancer if you still have a uterus. Whereas when you have progesterone as well, then that offsets that. So if you've had a hysterectomy, for example, then you can have estrogen alone. Or if you have an IUD that also provides progesterone, then you can have estrogen alone. Otherwise, you have the combined estrogen and progesterone. These are taken as a pill or a patch or a gel.
But there was a recent controversy around this drug in the scientific community, right?
Yeah, so this is what was called the Women's Health Initiative study. And it was a really important study. It's worth saying that, even though it's been heavily critiqued, it was a really important study. So it was published just over 20 years ago, and it was using older versions, that's important to mention, older versions of hormone replacement therapy, which were made from the urine of pregnant horses, which was very normal at the time. It sounds really wacko, but it was very normal at the time. And this study was designed to look at what effect it had on the risk of cancer, heart disease, and osteoporosis. Mm. It wasn't looking at the effect on symptoms. It was purely designed to look at the longer-term health consequences of taking HRT. What it did find was that there was an increased risk of blood clots, of stroke, breast cancer, and heart attacks. Small increases, but an increased risk. Now, the thing that's really important to know about this study is that most of the women in the study were postmenopausal. So their average age was around 63. And the reason that that's important is that there is now growing evidence that the timing of HRT or MHT is really important, and that if you are giving it earlier in perimenopause, there's evidence that it does reduce the risk of, for example, heart disease. So the other thing that's important to know about this study, as I mentioned, is that it was using older formulations because this study was conducted, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But those formulations obviously have changed a lot since then. We now have much more biosimilar, so they're much more like the hormones that are naturally occurring in the human body. We have patches and gels, for example, so that there's you can have lower dose, doesn't need to be processed by the liver. So there's a lot that has changed since that time. And I think it's also important to mention as well with that study, it wasn't looking at symptoms. This wasn't looking at does HRT work to relieve the symptoms of perimenopause. And that's really why you take HRT. Most women, in fact, I don't think any women are going to be put on HRT to reduce their risk of heart disease. They're going to be taking it for symptoms. And so I guess the controversy, apart from the fact it was really misreported in the media at the time, and the use of HRT absolutely tanked. Women were just coming off it left, right, and center. Doctors were afraid to prescribe it. And the shadow that has cast over MHT has been long and unjustified, to the point that doctors today are still uncertain about prescribing HRT because of that study, even though there are so many reasons why the data from that study does not really apply in today's context.
What impact has that also had on kind of research that's been able to be done about the effectiveness of the treatment?
Well, it killed research. It killed research on HRT for a long time because it was seen as a definitive, well, this is bad for you.
Right.
So why would we want to put women through that? So it really killed it for at least a decade. Thankfully, because we have newer formulations, research is starting to happen. And what's also important is it's research that's being led by women as well, which is great because, you know, you want women who are actually experiencing this and bringing that kind of, I guess, the perspective of people who have ovaries, people who menstruate, bringing that perspective to this question. And also, you know, there's some great studies. There's one happening in Australia where they're actually going to women saying, what do you want to know? And I think that's really important because it is such a subjective experience. It's not something that you can say all women experience this, or all, you know, all people with ovaries experience this. So it is changing, and we are getting more research. But, you know, if you're looking at something like the effect on breast cancer or heart disease, you need a long study and you need a lot of people, and that takes time and it takes money.
A lot of people might be scared to be taking it because of this very long ago study. And at the same time, there's this complexity around, is it just my hormones, or is it, you know, do I want treatment in the first place? And then there's also this debate that you write about between hormones and mental health care when it comes to menopause. Can you talk me through that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a really challenging one. As I said, you know, this period in life can be very challenging for all people, not just women. I mean, there are so many societal issues that we deal with. And for example, you know, I think there's the perspective of, oh, well, we can't have a female president because, you know, in menopause she'll hit the red button. You know, it's that kind of a mentality. And then there's also the, you know, a woman who's experiencing domestic violence prescribing hormone therapy to a perimenopausal woman who's facing homelessness or experiencing domestic violence is not going to solve her problems. And so it's really, as I said earlier, and there's a fabulous researcher, Professor Jayashree Kulkarni in Melbourne at Monash, and, you know, she talks about this biopsychosocial dimension where you can't look at any of those things in isolation. You can't just look at the biological side of things. You can't just look at the psychological side of things. And you can't just look at the social side of things in the perimenopausal transition. You have to consider all of those things together to work out what is going to be the solution or the best way to ensure the best quality of life and health for this person. Those are big questions. And, you know, we also live in a society that is very ageist, particularly against women. There are, you know, that kind of idea that older women are invisible and washed up. So we're also combating a society that views that devalues older women in particular. So there's so many dimensions to this problem. But, you know, what I keep coming back to is that if a woman is experiencing, or a person with ovaries is experiencing these hormonal fluctuations that are impacting their quality of life enough, why not try something that could at least address that side of their life experience? Because it may or may not work, but, you know, what do we stand to lose?
Hmm. Well, I mean, that brings me back to your own personal story and your own personal choice that you're facing now with this treatment. You've mentioned that you're still weighing up whether or not to take the treatment. What are some of the things you're weighing up right now?
Taking any medication should never be taken lightly. Mm. You know, you are altering your biochemistry. There is cost associated with that. There are always side effects and risks. And certainly, you know, 2 months ago, I was thinking, this sucks. I hate this. And I do not want to feel like this for the next however many years. Whereas this month, I'm like, oh, you know what? This is actually okay. It's not too bad. I've had so many women say, it was a lifesaver. It was fantastic. And that's really positive to hear. You know, I think there's also growing evidence of benefit, longer-term benefit, for example, with reducing the risk of osteoporosis, which is fragile bones and bone breakage. You know, I'm quite a physically active person and also incredibly clumsy, so that would be something that would be really nice to reduce my risk of having a hip fracture at some point in time. It can reduce my risk of heart disease. I do think the evidence is there if I take it early. So, I think in the grand scheme of things, I'm probably leaning towards giving it a go. But, I'm not sure. I think it's going to be something where I might just have a really shitty week and go, you know what, I'm done. Let's give it a go. But at the moment, that's not this week.
Hmm. And, you know, what about the social developments that could help? I mean, obviously, we've talked a bit about the way we perceive it as a society, but also just really practical workplace measures. Like what are some of the social developments that you think could really help people going through this in the workplace?
I think anecdotally, a lot of women say that flexible, you know, who are working in-house say that flexible workplaces can be a real benefit. You know, if you are having a day when you're really not feeling up to it, you know, you are really sweaty and disgusting and hot, then being able to work from home is really important. I think also, you know, if you're having major sleep disruptions, again, workplace flexibility, being able to start a little bit later in the morning, and look, these things are not, you know, it's not complicated. It's not rocket science. And I think what we've really seen in the pandemic, one silver lining was how much flexible work arrangements and the ability to work from home benefits so many people, you know, people with disabilities, women experiencing endometriosis. It's so beneficial to have that flexibility, but also recognizing that, you know, workplaces, for example, air conditioning has been, you know, written about so many times, is set up for the male physiology, not the female physiology. So recognizing that, you know, workplaces might need to be a little bit more flexible around who's in charge of the air conditioning and setting the air conditioning, or uniforms that are less constrictive, fabrics that are better if somebody's having hot flushes. There's so many things that are really going to need to be tailored to individual workplaces and to individual women. But I think most importantly, it's also about understanding and education and understanding and, you know, that awareness that just because a woman is perimenopausal, that doesn't mean she's not functioning. She's probably functioning twice as effectively as somebody else, as a man, dare I say it, in that setting, because there are so many things going on, and she's still succeeding and doing her job and delivering, you know, the extraordinary things that that women do. And but I think it's understanding is it goes a long way, and conversation and sharing is really important, which is something that I think women do really well anyway.
That was Bianca Nogrady. She's a science writer for Guardian Australia. You can read more of Bianca's work on theguardian.com. We've linked to her latest piece about perimenopause treatment on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by James Milsom, sound design and mixing by Joe Koning. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also leave us a review. I'm Jane Lee. Catch you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.